Welcome to True Talk on WMNF 88.5 with Ahmed and Summer. Summer is out today, and it's just me in the studio, and we're live. Today, we're going to be speaking about what's happening in India and repression against minority communities, including Muslims and Christians and others. We'll be speaking with a journalist residing in California, Peter Frederick, who will be speaking about that. Also, your phone calls and more. This is True Talk on WMNF. We'll be right back. Welcome to True Talk on WMNF 88.5. Ahmed, this is Ahmed Badir. This is my show today and every Thursday from 11 to 12. Used to be on Fridays, but now it's on Thursdays. My co-host Summer is not joining us today. She will be hopefully back next week. On today's program, we'll be speaking about repression targeting Muslims and other minorities in India. India actually happens to be one of the largest Muslim communities in the world. They're still a minority in India, Muslims are. However, because India is so large, they're still one of the largest communities, Muslim communities in the world. Let me look up what's the Muslim population in India. And if you're wondering why I'm looking up Muslim population in India, it's because this is a show, True Talk, if you're new to it, Global Affairs show, talks a lot about relations between the U.S. and the Middle East, the Muslim world, that part of the world. I happen to be Muslim, so I'm especially interested in it. It says here that the Muslim population in India is 200 million. India's Muslim population is about the world's third largest and the world's largest Muslim minority population. India is home to 10% of the world's Muslim population, according to Pew Research Center. There can be 213 million Muslims in 2020. India's 15.5% population. That's what it says on Wikipedia. And of course, Wikipedia is always 100% accurate. I'm waiting for my guest, Peter Frederick, to join. Let me find out where he's at. And also, I wanted to talk about what's happening in Sudan. Because as you know, there was a military coup there that's happening or happened this week. And what are the repercussions there? It just seems whenever Arabs or Muslims want to be able to revolt and have a revolution and establish democracy and try to get, you know, self-determination or, you know, civilian rule, there's always these count. It's just they won't let them do it. I mean, we saw the Arab Spring, what happened in Tunisia, in Egypt, in Libya, in Syria, in Yemen, just throughout the whole region, all the countries, all the populations. And, you know, they were celebrated around the world as how they were rising up and defeating these dictators, only to be to have counter-revolutions. And it appears, you know, Sudan had their moment, and now it has been reversed with a military coup. There was, you know, an agreement for power sharing for a while, or at least, you know, it was kind of an agreement between the civilian leadership and the military. And the military seemed to have reneged. Where is my guest, I'm asking? Let me find out, and I'll be right back. This is True Talk on WMNF, and you can continue listening to Shab Khalid. Welcome back to True Talk on Welcome back to True Talk on WMNF 88.5 with Ahmed Badir. And Summer is out today. And now I'm joined by Peter Frederick. Peter is has been researching Southeast Asia and its global diaspora for over 15 years. And for the past 5 years, he's been particularly focused on the rise of the Hindu nationalist movement in India, as well as its international networks. He's the author of Saffron Fascists, India's Hindu Nationalist Rulers, as well as several other books and publications. He's a resident of California. Welcome to True Talk.
Yes, hello. Thank you for having me.
Thanks, Peter. Why did you decide to focus on India? You're not Indian, right? I mean, Peter.
Not Indian. Okay. No, I'm actually a native of California.
Okay. Well, beautiful state.
Yes. Yes. Actually, I just got here to Florida. It's I flew into the Orlando airport yesterday, and I was amazed that landing. I heard a song about California in the airport.
Okay. Well, it's how did you like the humidity when you landed?
You know, it's not too bad. Okay. You know, I suppose it's far different from California, but it's a lot colder in where I'm from in Northern California, in Sacramento at the moment. I'm glad I'm out here, 3 months earlier.
Yeah. In the summer, it's much more humid. But welcome to Florida. We're going to get to why you're in Florida in a bit, but native of California, or, you know, semi-native. I'm assuming you're not a native indigenous, but European native. Why the interest in India, Southeast Asia and India specifically, and even the Hindu nationalist movement even more?
Well, you know, I got into it about 15 years ago researching South Asia, when I encountered members of the Indian diaspora, especially Sikhs and the Dalit community, those who are formerly known as untouchables, the outcasts of the caste system in India. And I became particularly interested from the outset with the Sikh community and what they'd experienced in 1984, which was a genocide in Delhi at the hands of the Indian state, which was actually the opposition party today. Back then, it was the ruling party, the Congress. And I began interacting with them and with the Dalit community and researching and writing about the Sikh religion, about the history of the anti-caste struggle in India, and overall human rights situation in India, which was not great about 15 years ago. There were a lot of issues and a lot of unresolved issues related to these things like the 1984 Sikh genocide, but as well as other pogroms, large-scale massacres of minorities that have been staged by the Hindu nationalist movement. And so then, as I continued doing that, the new government in India, the BJP, which is a Hindu nationalist political party, came into power in 2014. And I began to shift my focus to more specifically focus on the BJP and its background, its goals, which is Hindu nationalism, that's its underlying ideology, as well as its background, where it came from, how that movement developed, which it developed back in the 1920s. And since about the past 5 years, I have pretty much exclusively focused on researching, reporting on, and speaking about issues related to what the BJP and its parent organization, known as the RSS, are doing in India, and what their international networks, of which they have quite a number, are doing outside of India, particularly in the U.S.
And what are they doing in India, the Hindu nationalists?
Well, Hindu nationalism is this idea that being an Indian means being a Hindu. And that anyone in India who is not a Hindu does not belong in the country. It seeks to turn India into an official Hindu state along the lines of, say, for instance, an Islamic Republic or a Christian nation. It seeks to eliminates and or assimilates all non-Hindus in India, of which there are hundreds of millions, particularly the largest non-Hindu minority population is the Muslim population. But there is also a large Christian population, Sikh population, Buddhists. The Hindu nationalist movement really launched off in 1925 with the founding of this group called the RSS. The RSS is a paramilitary organization, which was founded in around the exact same time as the European fascist movements of Mussolini and Hitler were taking root and developing. And has currently about 6 million members. It's uniformed, it's armed, it's all male. And it has a stated goal from its origins of eradicating particularly Muslims and Christians from the country. It views them as members of foreign races, as even calls them as traitors to the nation because they are Indians who are not Hindus. And it has attempted over the past many decades since 1925 to put that ideology into violent practice on many occasions where their efforts have sparked large-scale pogroms against both Muslim and Christian populations. The most recent was in 2008 against Christians, and then previously in 2002 against Muslims. In 2002, the pogrom against Muslims was conducted in Gujarat, where the current Prime Minister of India, Narendra Modi, was at the time the Chief Minister of the state of Gujarat. He had actually just a few days earlier become Chief Minister. Right. And as he took office, there was a three-day pogrom that sparked off against Muslims, in which the RSS and a variety of its many subsidiary organizations took to the streets in a highly organized fashion and just slaughtered up to about 2,000 Muslims, men, women, and children, in unspeakable ways. Tainted Modi's record internationally for a long time. He was actually banned from coming to the U.S. As well as the U.K. And yet it helped to promote him and elevate him in the eyes of the Hindu nationalist movement. And he then ended up becoming Prime Minister of India.
So is he part of, what does RSS stand for again?
RSS stands for Rashtriya Swayamsevak Sangh.
What does that
which
mean?
Which means essentially National Volunteer Corps.
Okay, Volunteer Corps sounds like something nice. People, you know, encouraging volunteering, but what do they actually want, this RSS?
Well, they actually want to control the nation, which at the moment they've virtually achieved. Narendra Modi himself is a lifelong RSS member. He joined, I believe, when he was about 8 years old.
How many members are there?
There's about 6 million.
So 6 million
which is not to count. The RSS additionally has a very wide variety of special interest subsidiaries, including a religious wing, a student wing, a wing for lawyers, a wing for a labor wing,
organized. All Hindus?
They are primarily all Hindus. They do boast a Muslim wing called the Rashtriya Muslim Manch and a Sikh wing. But those are basically window dressing wings that they have developed over the past 20 years or so in order to whitewash their actual goals and their actual image. Interestingly enough, the Muslim wing was formed, I believe, in December of 2002, about 6 months after the RSS staged the pogrom in Gujarat against Muslims.
So there's a Muslim wing in RSS. Why would a Muslim want to be part of that if they're targeting Muslims?
Well,
or is it just window dressing?
It is just window dressing, I would say that. Yeah.
What I'm reading online here, it says that, and what people have told me is that the RSS is working to unite the Hindu community to form a Hindu Rashtra or a Hindu nation. Would that be accurate? And then they want to spread the Hindutva ideology.
I would add to that that they are working to unite. They're working to homogenize the Hindu community. The Hindu religion is vast. It's diverse. It's varied. It's has a long history in many ways of pluralism and tolerance. But the RSS's specific goal is to homogenize it and bring it all under the exact same traditions. And then from there to militarize and politicize it.
It says here that this RSS had been banned before, several times by the Indian government.
Yes.
I'm not sure. Was it an RSS member that actually assassinated Gandhi?
It was an RSS member that assassinated Gandhi. Interestingly enough, that happened in 1948, which was the same year that the RSS's international wing was formed outside of India. The RSS has been banned in India three times. The first time was after a RSS member assassinated Gandhi. The second time was in the 70s. That was more for political reasons. And the third time was in 1992 after the RSS and its subsidiaries as in a gathered in a campaign that was led by members of the BJP, including the president at the time, I believe, of the BJP. They gathered in hundreds of thousands outside of a mosque on a disputed territory in central India. And after a long campaign against the mosque, which they contested was built on the site where one of the Hindu deities was born, the mob tore down the mosque and subsequently launched a several-month nationwide, generally across northern India, campaign of massacring Muslims, which led to approximately over a couple of months, 2,000 to 3,000 deaths of Muslims.
Okay,
that led to the RSS being banned for the third time.
Okay, so that's the RSS. You also mentioned something, the BJP, because there's a lot of acronyms here, and for our listeners that are not familiar, these are all right. Are they all? Would it be fair to say that these are all right wing groups in India, Hindu groups?
Well,
is
so
the BJP this kind of the same?
The BJP, the Bharatiya Janata Party, and yes, you're correct. That's one of the problems with discussing this is that there's such an alphabet soup.
Yeah.
But the BJP is a political party. It is essentially de facto the political wing of the RSS.
Okay.
So the RSS is the mother organization, and among its many special interest subsidiaries, one of the primary ones is the BJP, which is its political party. The BJP was actually formed by two RSS workers who formed it in 1980 and is primarily the foot soldiers, campaign workers of the BJP are generally RSS workers, RSS members.
So who controls who? Does RSS control BJP or BJP control RSS, or do they coexist?
Well, that's a great question. the BJP will regularly contest that it is independent, it's its own decision-making body, and so on and so forth. But currently, about 75% of the cabinet members of the central government are members of the RSS in one form or the other, or have been, including Narendra Modi, the prime minister, including the president, including the home minister, who's including a host of others. And the RSS and the BJP routinely hold summits together, openly hold summits together, in which they discuss policy making and political goals. It's come out, U.S. ambassadors in the past have made remarks that have been leaked through WikiLeaks, in which they themselves admit that the BJP cannot exist without the RSS, and that the RSS is essentially the backbone of the BJP.
Their existence is codependent on each other. Okay. Both of them, are they? So what's Hindutva? Hindutva, is that an ideology they both share, or this is like a, you know?
Yeah. Hindutva is an ideology that they both share. Hindutva is the underlying ideology of both the RSS and the BJP. Hindutva is a religious nationalist political ideology. It's essentially another word for it's the Indian term for Hindu nationalism. It's this ideology that
is it like Hindu supremacy?
It's like Hindu supremacy. Yeah, it's like Hindu supremacy.
Okay. Yes. How is it? You know, I mean, with these, so because oftentimes when you think supremacy, you never really you think of white people, white Europeans. You think of Nazis. You think of these types. You don't really think of brown people having a supremacy type movement. Are these Hindutva movement has the same kind of ideology as the white supremacists that were in Germany?
I would contrast Hindu nationalism with white nationalism in a variety of ways. One of the ways is just that they share a lot of similar ideas and concepts. You know, the idea of ethnic supremacy, the idea of sacrificing oneself for the fatherland or motherland being the highest calling of a citizen, you know, so on and so forth. The idea of uniformity and conformity being the ideal situation for a citizenry, etc. But Hindu nationalism and white nationalism, I also contrast with each other because they share a history. The RSS was founded in 1925, which is 1920s was exactly when Mussolini was founding his fascist party in Italy, and Hitler was emerging in Germany and publishing Mein Kampf. He actually published it in 1925 and reformulated the SS in 1925. Well, over the next 15 years, from 1925 to 1940, the RSS ideologues, including the man who ended up becoming the second and longest serving leader of the RSS, published a wide variety of material in which they called out the European fascists and pointed to them as a model of what they were attempting to achieve in India. They admired the way in which they were pushing for territorial expansion. They admired the way in which they viewed minorities as in the country as something that could not be assimilated into society, and which they called out while identifying the European fascists. They called out the minorities and said that they should at best be pushed into second class citizenship, stripped of citizenship rights, most famously. They pointed to, in so many words, the purging of the Jews in Germany, and called it a good lesson to learn and profit by, something that they wanted to emulate in India. Another one of them pointed to Indian Muslims and directly compared them, in so many words, to German Jews, saying that the goal was for them to be treated in the same manner. And then, furthermore, one of the five co-founders of the RSS in the 1930s actually traveled to fascist Italy and met Mussolini and toured his fascist institutions. And then upon returning, wrote about how much he admired them, about how India needed something similar that would militarize the Hindus along the lines of the militarization of the people in Italy, and directly stated that the RSS was such an institution. And we could further delve into ways in modern times in which there have been interactions going both ways between white nationalists or white supremacists and Hindu nationalists.
Right. So it seems like it's deep-rooted. It's surprising to me that these guys who were outlawed and banned in India on three occasions, their members were responsible for actually killing, Gandhi, that now they're in power in India and have been there for a while. And they're
7 years now.
Yeah. How many years?
7 years.
7 years. How did they come to power if they were, such evil fascists? I mean, because oftentimes we hear that India is like the world's biggest democracy and it's often praised. But then, how did this group rise to power and continues to have a grip on power there?
Well, it came to power. You have to consider that the RSS was founded in 1925. And I would argue that the RSS has a long-term mindset, and they have been working, as is warned by a number of prominent Indian journalists. They've been working systematically over the past number of decades, particularly in a number of states like Gujarat, to infiltrate the police services, the judiciary, even most of the civil service and administrative services of the government, as well as to work behind the scenes outside of the political arena to inculcate the population with their ideology of Hindutva or Hindu nationalism. Now, when the 2014 election occurred, the Indian National Congress, the opposition party, was fairly widely perceived as corrupt. And it was also widely perceived as a dynastic political party, which I would argue it is, where the political power of the party was passed down from generation to generation to within the same family. And that was widely used to the advantage of the BJP as a tool to gain support. India at the time, the BJP didn't come in promising in 2014 that it was going to transform India into a Hindu Rashtra. Those who study it and were aware of its origins and its nature, its ideology, were aware that that was basically its goal, but that is not what they campaigned on. They campaigned on a good economy and boosting the image of India internationally and putting food on the tables of Indians. So that got them into power in 2014. They came back into power in 2019. And when they came back into power in 2019, they had already spent a number of years during the first tenure, the first 5-year tenure, in particular doing things like going after the political opposition and after dissenters, and beginning to make it very uncomfortable for people to the point that they might be risking prison if they voiced out against the ruling party. They also ramped up their radicalization of the population, which is now here in 2021, showing some very disturbing results. I guess that's how I would argue that's how they got into power.
Okay, now that they've been in power and they're basically trying to eliminate the opposition to remain in power, how has the U.S. responded to India's or to the rise of this group, which you say is fascist? The RSS and the BJP coming to power, because I know under Trump, I saw that Modi, the prime minister, when he came to the U.S., they had like some big event for him in Texas.
Trump and Modi did the dance of love around the auditorium.
What is that? Is that still happening, or what happened during Trump? What's happening now? I don't want to interrupt you, but I should just remind our listeners, because in case you just joined us, we're speaking to Peter Frederick, He is a journalist, freelance researcher and journalist focusing on Southeast Asia. And we're speaking about India and specifically the rise of this group, RSS, and the BJP right-wing groups that share something called Hindutva ideologies. And it's repressing and its repression of minority groups in India. Go ahead. Sorry to interrupt you.
Yeah, you have to look at the relationship with Modi's regime in India and the U.S. And look at it, differentiate between the Trump and the Biden era. Now, under Trump, as mentioned, Trump was doing the dance of love with Modi in Houston. About a month or two later, I believe, he then went to India, went to Modi's home state of Gujarat, and once again did the dance of love with him there and had a rock star reception thrown for him in Gujarat, which incidentally happened just as the RSS BJP was launching a pogrom against Muslims in Delhi, which was in February 2020. And, you know, while Modi was in Houston with Trump, they had this massive reception, 50,000 people came. While up on stage, Modi was actually quite literally promising Trump that he supported Trump's reelection, which I would view as a fairly high level of foreign interference in American political scene. Well, now we have Biden. And there was a lot of expectation among the Indian diaspora that the relationship with Modi's regime in India would change when Biden came into the presidency because of his concern for human rights, because of his progressive outlook. And initially, it seemed like that might be the case. But over the past 9 months, that seems to be actually not proving true. And I would cite in particular two recent issues. One is Modi came to visit Biden for the first time in the U.S. About 4 weeks ago, 5 weeks ago, 5 weeks ago. And the visit, the way in which it was conducted was generally interpreted as Biden kind of showing a cold shoulder to Modi. Modi first spoke alongside VP Harris. And while she was speaking, she dropped these subtle remarks about the need, importance of protecting and preserving democracy, and about how that may not yet have been achieved in both of our respective countries. Then Modi went to the White House, where Biden did not greet him directly personally when he arrived at the White House. And then when the two of them spoke alongside together, Biden, to his face, dropped remarks about how there's a pressing urgency today to protect and preserve the tolerance and pluralism of Gandhi's message. Well, that was interpreted as this subtle and gentle pressing by the U.S. that it's concerned about what's happening in Modi's India. But just 2 weeks prior to that, there was another incident which seemed to send the exact opposite message. And that was that the acting ambassador to India, the U.S.'s acting ambassador, was acting because Biden has appointed L.A. Mayor Eric Garcetti to be the permanent ambassador, but he has not yet been confirmed by the Senate. And so until that time, there are temporary ambassadors. The acting ambassador, Atul Keshab, on literally the last day of his tenure, right before he was leaving India, ending his temporary posting, went to the RSS headquarters and staged a photo op with the chief of the RSS, and then himself personally put it out through his official channels on his U.S. ambassadorial Twitter, praising the good discussion with the RSS chief and highlighting how they had discussed these issues of democracy and of pluralism and of so on and so forth. Which has been compared now by a number of people to somebody, some ambassador from the U.S. visiting a neo-Nazi group somewhere in the West, and then talking about how they had a great discussion about the values of
socialism. So what was the reaction to that?
Well, the reaction has been a little bit... the U.S. media hasn't picked it up at all. The U.S. media has completely ignored it, not even a one paragraph. It was reported in Indian media. U.S. media, I chalk that up to the fact that Americans, by and large, are generally completely ignorant about what's happening in India, about the ins and outs of the political scenario, and in particular, about the RSS. They have absolutely no clue what the RSS is.
Most people are unaware. Yeah. So but if you tell people in America, like RSS, they won't know what you're talking about.
Exactly. Exactly. But within the diaspora here in America, there has been outcry. There was a joint statement that was put out by 10 major Indian American diaspora organizations calling for the ambassador's removal from the diplomatic service entirely, considering it an indication that he's unfit for service. There have been three protests in three different states against his visit by Indian diaspora. There have been a number of people, journalists, Indian journalists, speaking out and denouncing it. There was a congressman from Maryland, Congressman David Trone, who issued a letter to Keshav himself, questioning the meeting and arguing that it legitimized the RSS, which has a history of violence against Christians and Muslims. And there's still continuing to be growing developments in the story, but much more needs to happen.
Let's just back up a little bit. And if, by the way, if you're just joining us, this is True Talk on WMNF, and I'm speaking to Peter Frederick. He's a freelance journalist and researcher that focuses on Southeast Asia, specifically India, and the rise of Hindu nationalism, groups like RSS and BJP. Can you tell us, at what level is this repression happening in India today? And is it just Muslims that are being affected? How are Muslims being, you know, oppressed in India and other groups as well? What is the government doing there that we should be alarmed about?
It is not just Muslims. Muslims are probably the most hated and primary target of the RSS BJP, but it's especially also Christians. So Muslims and Christians. And beyond that, Dalits, Sikhs, and other communities as well. Now, how? In a variety of ways. For the RSS and its special interest subsidiaries have been acting with almost total impunity for the past 7 years of the Modi regime as vigilantes on the streets, patrolling the streets, targeting minorities over a variety of issues. With Muslims, for instance, one of the main ways in which they target them is by accusing them of being in possession of beef or of having slaughtered cows.
What's the problem with slaughtering cows and having possession of beef? I mean, most Americans would be guilty of that also.
The cow is considered to be a sacred animal within Hinduism. Which, be that what it is, but the RSS BJP have a desire to, beyond that, ensure that nobody else in India views the cow in any other way, and also to legislate that religious belief.
Okay, but right now, the law does not forbid people eating cows or using...
Well, the law has increasingly begun to do so.
Okay.
Yes. So... aside from these vigilante groups, there have been a number of legislative actions on both the state and national level, which have worked to enact the Hindu nationalist agenda. One of those on this number of the states in India is the passage of anti-beef laws or anti-cow slaughter laws, which essentially, depending on the state, it varies. But essentially criminalize the slaughter and possession of beef and make it a crime punishable by anywhere from 5 years to 10 years in prison if caught doing so. At the same time, there are a number of outspoken Hindu nationalist activists who have called for the death penalty being instituted for anybody caught in possession of beef or slaughtering cows.
A death penalty. I mean, the U.S. meat industry lobbyists would be in uproar over that, and should be. I don't know if they're actually doing anything about it. But other than the issue of cows and beef, what about houses of worship? What about other life for Muslims and other minorities in India?
Well, that's another one of the major issues, is the issue of religious conversion. India is about 80% Hindu, I believe about 14% Muslim, and then 2 to 3% Christian, and 2 to 3% Sikh, and so on. So the Hindu nationalist movement essentially does not believe in freedom of religion. They believe that there is widespread use of force or fraud or incentives, such as financial incentives, being given to people to convert and change their religion away from Hinduism, of which there is no evidence. However, because of that, they have, over the past number of years, worked throughout several different states to pass what are called anti-conversion laws. These laws basically make it a crime to change your religion without the permission of the government. And they work in a variety of ways because of how they're written. But some of them require that if you want to change your religion, you have to wait 30 days and then go receive permission from the local government magistrate, who may be a Hindu, may be a member of the RSS, may be a voter for the BJP. And that if you fail to do so, you and or the person involved in the conversion process or the conversion ritual may face jail time.
I mean, that's just like so strange for us to hear that in America, especially when we are, you know, the First Amendment, freedom of religion. It's just ingrained in our society. You can be whatever religion you want or no religion, but you're saying this democracy that's and praised there is us, like you can't convert.
Never knows. I mean, let me ask you, does the government know? Is it on any paperwork?
No, it's not even counted.
Filed with the government?
No,
it's not even counted.
They exactly. Can't even count it because it would be against the Constitution. But in India, somehow, I guess, has it always been the case? You know, people were free to convert how they want to, but now they want people to stop. They want to keep them Hindu by force?
Yes.
Well, it's just crazy. I'm looking at headlines overnight out of India, and maybe this was where some of the confusion could be, where people don't realize the repression is happening. I think the media, especially Western media or mainstream media, however you want to call it, doesn't say it clearly. There's a headline, for example, in the Washington Post that says, Muslims attacked Hindus in Bangladesh, now Hindus are attacking Muslims. I mean, okay, what? It's like, you know, as a somehow justifying what's happening. That's in the Washington Post. The BBC has a better headline that says anti-Muslim violence flares up in India state. So they actually call it what it is. But what's happening right now in this in one of the Indian states, Tripura, there are some attacks on some mosques there. I think I'm mispronouncing it.
Yeah, so in Tripura, let me back up to Bangladesh. A couple of weeks ago, there was violence that flared up in Bangladesh. And there's, I think, a 10% Hindu minority in Bangladesh. Bangladesh is a Muslim majority country. For a few days, there was some ghastly violence. A couple of people were killed. Some Hindu temples were, I believe, burned. And there was some unspeakable violence. What happened then was that the government in this Muslim majority country responded by issuing a call for unity, denouncing the attacks, and arresting most of those who were accused.
So the government actually reacted in the proper way, because they're not,
yes.
You know, they're against what was happening.
Yes.
The Bangladesh government against the anti-Hindu violence.
That's correct.
Okay.
And
I'll give you
one guess which of between that, and I'll lay out what's happening in India, but I'll give you one guess which of these two governments the U.S. government has called out? Which of these two incidents of violence the U.S. government has called out?
Maybe I would just guess, wild guess, Bangladesh is who they called out.
You got it. Okay. You got it. Yeah, there were a number. There was actually quite a number of U.S. reps who called it out, and rightly so. But have been completely silent on what's happening.
Okay, so then what happened in India?
So over the past month, especially, and I chalk it up arguably, theoretically, to this meeting between the U.S. ambassador and the RSS, offering, sending a sign to the RSS and its cohorts that the U.S. Was going to legitimize it as a normal above board organization and continue to do what it's been doing for a long time and turn a blind eye to what's happening in India. Well, what's happening in India over the past months is things have been bad for minorities over the past 7 years, and especially over the past 2 years since Modi gained re-election and secured his position for a second term. But there has been an absolute explosion of violence across not just this one state, Tripura, which is on the border of Bangladesh, but against across the whole country. Throughout the country, over the past month, there have been so many incidents that I can't even begin to describe them. There have been Hindu nationalist activists with BJP politicians standing by their side on the stage, calling for beheading Christians, and calling their supporters to be the ones to start to ignite the fire and not be afraid to go to jail for doing so. There have been in central India, in the state of Chhattisgarh, there have been mobs of thousands of people who were led by the son of the former BJP chief minister of that state, as well as by a sitting BJP member of parliament, who in leading this mob was parading through the streets chanting, whenever Hindus have awakened, Muslims have fled the country. And when Muslims are slaughtered, then they will chant the name of Ram. And subsequently, this mob for a day or two rampaged through the area and attacked attacked mosques and Muslim-owned homes and businesses.
While the police are watching them do this. So it's almost as if they're protecting them. So that's the difference to what happened in Bangladesh, where the government is against and they cracked down and arrested the people. But in India, exactly. The actual police stands by and protects
the actual police,
vandalizers.
And the actual members of the ruling party. Beyond that, there have been incidents a couple of weeks ago. In one Sunday, there were 13 incidents across the country where Christian services were invaded by Hindu activists, Hindu nationalist activists, and sometimes to the tune of a couple of hundred people, or I think one incident, 500 people, they said, were invading the services, busting them up, destroying the inside of the church, dragging the worshipers out, and threatening them. There have been this incident with the mob parading through the streets and chanting genocidal slogans against Muslims. That was repeated in a neighboring state again, and there they were shouting, "Shoot the traitors,"
which
is a slogan, "Shoot the traitors."
I'm running out of time, but I wanted to get to this important question. In 1 minute, why should Americans care and what can they do about it or should do?
Well, Americans should care because we already know that China's a totalitarian state. Nobody's arguing that. We already know that Russia is essentially a dictatorship, a autocracy, whatever you want to call it. It's not a free country. India, however, is widely perceived in America as a stable, developing democracy where there is general freedom for the population. And so aside from that perception, or perhaps in addition, because of that perception, India is faster and faster becoming a crucial, very close ally of the U.S., which the U.S. wants India as an ally in order to balance.
10 seconds.
Americans should care also because this is touching us here in America, because the RSS is boosted. The RSS is boosted by its support base here in America.
Okay. Thank you, Peter, for this time, and hope to have you on again in the future. This is True Talk on WMNF.